So the cover of your book seems like it invokes or evokes American Psycho.
Yeah, there's definitely, this picture of this man who's half barcode. He's definitely transitioning towards something, I think, and eventually that barcode will encompass his whole person.
Right. So, well, was it intentional, the similarity to American Psycho? Were you aware of that?
No, I didn't think of that, but...
He even looks a bit like Christian Bale.
Yeah, we had a couple of other ideas for possible covers. One of them was kind of like two faces on the same body. And I kind of liked that, but we decided to go with this instead. Same basic idea, though, the sort of split personality.
Yeah. Well, because the corporate identity is commonly thought of now, so I'm reluctant to just make it sound like my own opinion, but it does seem to make sense to me as a sociopathic one.
I think that gives them almost a little too much credit, because sociopath has like emotions that they're acting upon, desires that they're acting upon. The sociopath actually has autonomy. The bureaucrat is almost sort of divorced from his own emotions and his own desires and his own feelings. He can act on it.
So it could be an evolutionary stage or a devolutionary stage beyond the sociopath then, even.
Yes, I would think so.
Because, I mean, I've had this experience recently, and I have talked about it on a podcast. It hasn't come out yet, so I'm willing to talk about it now a little bit, which was an experience of myself, or an aspect, a compartment of myself, to use the term you used in the book, or an alter that was essentially a killer, a cold-blooded killer, but the only, and like a machine, very much so, but the only kind of residual human emotion that seemed to exist within that identity was a kind of vicious, violent rage. And when you're describing, and this very MK Ultra, you know, creating these program killers, they create an alter that really kind of is turbocharged by all the rage, you know, that isn't able to be distributed throughout the whole body and therefore healed, or therefore turned into a positive energy, or whatever would happen. Otherwise, it just gets, you know, redirected into a single social alter that is this American Psycho kind of guy. And it occurred to me, when you're describing the future as this kind of organic machine realm in which there is no consciousness, or just this very low bandwidth of consciousness, which I can't think is the world we live in, but anyway, I know what you mean, like it could go several steps further in that direction, that we have this kind of general view of it being this very cold, sterile place in which nothing much happens, in which robot people just move around smoothly. But the picture I'm getting is the very inverse of that. It's just an unbelievably violent world.
Yes, I think that violence is sort of indistinguishable from a society that's dealing with a lack of identity. I don't think everybody resorts to violence when they're lacking identity, but I do think that it is inevitable that we will see an increase in violence as we transition away from things that are real and begin sort of interacting with a world where everything is sort of disconnected from that which we can sort of see in front of us.
Yeah.
And it'll be mostly spiritual violence, I think, in the way that we've seen bureaucrats act. But I don't see a difference between school shootings and the sort of things that bureaucrats do to children. I think that they're one and the same in terms of their source.
Well, Robin Eubanks was on the podcast. Do you know her? Done the research into core education and stuff.
I know the name.
Yeah, she made a similar point when I was talking about the institutionalized sexual abuse of children in the UK. I'm pretty sure in the US too, but it's just come out much more in the UK. That based on what she had researched and discovered about the educational procedures, she didn't see any inherent difference in terms of, I mean, not in terms of necessarily the harm it did, but in terms of the kind of moral emptiness that was required to be able to sexually abuse children, was no greater than the kind required to implement these kinds of educational policies. Like, it was all of a piece, really, in terms of just completely unfeeling, ruthless violation of the child's psyche.
Yeah, it's not my area of expertise to the degree that I have any, but I definitely think that there is something to that, to the connection between the sort of violence that we see more broadly and what's going on in our schools. I think the school is probably the reason I spend so much time talking about schools in the book is because I feel like it's undergone so much change in such a short period of time that you get the whole picture of the entire society in school, because you've got the relatively uncorrupted children. You've got the teachers whose job has changed dramatically in such a short period of time. You've got the bureaucratic administrators who are now more like businessmen than they are principals or former teachers. And you've got all these different components sort of battling it out for dominance. And it's clear that the hierarchy, the data collection component of the school is going to win out over the more humanistic elements. And the school is just a great laboratory for watching these things sort of play out, particularly with children.
Right. Well, that point about data collection seems interesting and relevant, because that seems to be a lot of what Common Core is about, is sort of redesigning education as a means to collect as much information about students as possible in order to understand better how to condition and program them.
Yeah, they definitely see information as sort of the I forget how I would describe it originally in the book, but information is sort of almost sacred to them. It's kind of like it's like their religious text. It defines everything that they do. So the pursuit of information, because once they have information, they think that they have power to affect the reality. This is from the perspective of the machine.
And right, that's very much is, isn't it? Because a machine needs more data in order to extend its program.
We're seeing students take the brunt of this because they're being used less as people and more as information gathering kiosks, you know, or dispensing kiosks. And, you know, children have the least experience in dealing with this kind of inhuman bureaucracy. And so they don't know how to navigate the kinds of absurdities. They don't know how to avoid the bureaucrats. They just assume that they'll act humanely in the way that their parents act humanely towards them. And they just don't understand that teachers and principals can't be trusted to act like decent people. Not anymore.
So do you think part of it, I think you just compared schools where you did just now, in fact, but in the book also to a kind of laboratory, social science laboratory. Do you think that it's possible that at some level anyway, some of this apparently insane imposition of absurd rules could be a means to observe behaviors within those conditions? Like, you impose an insane rule and then you see how the subjects of the experiment respond to that.
I don't think that it's sort of an intentional kind of laboratory where they're like testing on mice. I do think that it's just, let's see how this works, and they're not really thinking about the effects that it has. They want the outcome, and they're sort of uninterested in what actually happens to the rats. Is this rat neurotic now? Well, they don't care about that. They just want the raw data.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to you know, the collection of information. I do think that this is sort of something that is going to increase. We're going to see student data being sold to private corporations. It's going to be increasingly moved up more and more so that we get a centralized database of all this information. And that's really what Common Core is really about. It's about unifying the data so that it can be centralized. So making sure that every student takes the same test so that they can more accurately measure the results. And on the surface, that might seem like a good thing, but there are unintended side effects of trying to centralize everything. And this sort of dehuman treatment of individuals at the micro level is a good example of that.
I don't necessarily want to go off on a real tangent, but to me it isn't a tangent, because it's where my mind's going, really, in terms of a context for all of this, and that is artificial intelligence. Should I fill that out for you, or does that already have an association for you with everything that we're talking about?
Well, like I said, I do think that intelligence is the direction that we're moving towards, where we're moving away from consciousness at the individual mm-hmm. level. And at the macro level, I do think that artificial intelligence is already with us. I mean, artificial intelligence exists in terms of the corporation. It may not seem that way because it seems more like a social construct, but yeah. In my view, it's very similar to the kinds of computer programs that we're creating now. They just operate by different rules, but the cogs, the individual pieces, are just human beings instead of microchips. But, you know, so obviously people are more complex, less reliable than microchips, which are either on or off. But I think the effect is the same, which is that you've created sort of a machine which either functions or it doesn't, or it malfunctions. But it's sort of, it does what it's designed to do, regardless of the desires of its individual components.
Right. So you're talking about an institution now, essentially, as a form of artificial intelligence.
Right. A lot of people like to imagine that in the future we're going to be ruled by robots or ruled by artificial intelligence. And you've got a lot of science fiction movies relating to this. Terminator, Westworld, that sort of thing. But in my view, we're already controlled by machines. Machines just take the different form. They take the form of the corporation or the government or other social groups, which in my view are machines.
We're talking about a machine that doesn't actually have a fixed encasement, let's say. It's a moving collective of individuals, but it's functioning as more or less as a machine functions. Is that fair to say what you're saying?
I would say so. And you know, the corporation obviously has hundreds of people working for it, and each of them have their own sort of desires, their own lives. But when they come together to work at that corporation, they function like a machine, and they do whatever the function of the machine is. So if it's to make money, it's to make money. If it's to wage war, then it's to wage war. And if an individual doesn't want to participate, well, then they'll be expunged from that machine. And even if all the people in the machine decide that they don't want to, then the machine doesn't change, it just ceases to exist.
Well, that on that point, there's a new variable there, which you probably considered, which is that the function of a machine, and this may be when intelligence actually emerges from the artifice, is always going to be to perpetuate its own existence and protect it, because that's the prime directive, right, of every organism, if it has some kind of sentience. And Ramsey Dukes has written about this. So then what would happen, and I think what does happen, is that the function of the machine, or in this case that we're talking about, the institution or the collective, because it becomes to perpetuate its existence, it then becomes the inverse of its declared function, because it exists in order to address a problem, but if it should solve the problem, then it would cease to have a reason to exist, so then it has to perpetuate the very problem that it was assembled to solve. So then, I mean, the easy example is hospital, the medical industry that conspires to make people sick. I would say Hollywood's quite a good example in that it makes entertainment that leaves people feeling like they haven't been entertained, right? They actually just need more and more. Mm-hmm. So in this way, corporations perpetuate and they expand. They create the conditions that requires their expansion.
And I think that you're right. Clearly there is sort of like a motivation towards creating more problems to solve. But typically with bureaucracies, they don't intentionally create the problems. It's just something that tends to happen is that they create more bureaucracy to solve problems because it works. Creating additional bureaucracy does actually work at solving like the micro problems that they're trying to address. The problem is that it creates unintended consequences.
Bigger problems.
Yeah, in our case, in the cases that I look at in the book, it's mostly the problems are psychological problems, which is from the perspective of the machine, completely invisible. They don't even see it.
Right, exactly. Irrelevant. Yeah. Well, let's use the very obvious, I'd say, inescapable example, and you brought it up already, school shootings. Now, I guess we should leave aside for now, like, how real these are, because of course in these liminal times there's all kinds of debate about whether they even really happen. But if we just leave that aside, certainly let's say some of them happen, some of them are real, not staged exactly, but whether they're being manipulated to happen or whether they're actually occurring spontaneously or both, kind of leave that aside also. But the conditions that you're describing in the beginning of the book, with these more and more restrictions and more harsh punishments around within schools, it's very clear that there's a direct correlation between this and the increase in school shootings, but in both directions, as in because of the preponderance of school shootings now, there's more and more fear and uncertainty and doubt within the school environments, by which if a girl brings a piece of paper to school that is vaguely shaped like a gun, she can get suspended and so on. But it's also pretty clear, pretty easy to see how children who are in that environment where they can get accused of being the next school shooter for almost nothing at all are that much more likely to actually bring a gun to school and shoot somebody at a certain point.
Yeah, I think lack of meaning is something that affects everybody in the society, and I don't know that it all comes from the machine apparatus. A lot of lack of meaning just comes from living in a society that's sort of detached and uncaring. So you have, your immediate family, and if you're lucky, they care about you unconditionally, but that's very rare outside of families. Most communities aren't like that. Certainly no corporation or school that I know of is like that. They may pretend to care, but that caring only goes so far. It goes to the point where you stop producing for them. Once you stop producing either good test scores or good work at your job, your sense of worth becomes subject to them. They don't see you quite as valuable anymore.
And I think that's generally true in families too, but anyway.
Well, you might be right, but I think that in families there is at least some willingness to suspend the practical in order to value the person without condition. And obviously, if a person becomes totally abusive, then you separate yourself from them. But there's still sort of a love that for parents for their children, or for children for their parents, that isn't completely destroyed, regardless of the situation. Even if it's truly horrible, there's always well, I shouldn't say always, but there's often an appreciation for that children have for their parents, and certainly in healthy families, that's there. But in unhealthy families, in schools, and in jobs, you have to produce in order to justify your existence. And so this desire to justify one's existence just doesn't go away.
Right.
And it's a pressure that's always there, and a lot of people can't define it. They can't define that sort of pressure to justify one's existence. And it builds a kind of pressure that sometimes erupts in violence. And people, to try and find some justification for being alive, they may turn to religion, they may turn to a particular ideology that may end up resulting in violence. But in the end, it's all about trying to find meaning in this world, trying to find some purpose that gives the insanity some kind of direction.
Quest for identity, yeah. If children are being framed, not literally, but in the sense they're being perceived and put into a perceptual framework as potential school shooters, are being actually, in some of the cases you cite, they're being criminalized, they're being given a criminal record for next to nothing, then that's the identity that is most freely available to them. Like, oh, I'm a criminal, I'm being perceived as a criminal. That for a child particularly, but I think for all of us, that's a subtle messaging that this is what you are expected to be.
Some cases, it's not so subtle. I mean, if you're being put in solitary confinement for truancy, which is certainly possible, then you know it becomes a much more of a fixed reality that you are a criminal now, because you're being treated in most countries solitary confinement is considered a crime. It's a human rights abuse,
right?
But here we don't have quite as many restrictions on it, and you can be put there for skipping school now. So I think that, and that has very real psychological effects, which are sort of impossible to get around. If you're put in solitary confinement for days and days, you're going to come out not quite the same person. And so I don't find it hard to believe that those people would begin to see themselves as criminals that they are being defined as.
Yeah, and then have the corresponding rage to actually embody that definition and act it out. And I mean, the same, actually, this is something that occurred to me some time ago, and I'm sure it's occurred to many other people, with in terms of the war on terror, quote-unquote. Like, it's hard to imagine a more efficient way to create terrorists than the kind of human rights abuses that have been perpetuated by the war on terror, in terms of renditioning Arabs and, you know, treating them as non-human beings and torture and all the rest of it. Of course you're going to create a whole new wave of people who actually want to commit acts of terror. So back to that kind of a system, a corporation, or an even an entire society or a culture that becomes kind of weirdly sentient in this machine-like way and has to perpetuate its existence. Well, primary way is to create the forces that will oppose it, because then that reinforces its reason to exist, and that negative identity just thrives on the opposition that it's creating.
Right, and the government clearly is a good example where they create their own enemies through their actions and they benefit from it. And unlike, say, corporation or individual who creates an enemy and then they have to sort of deal with those consequences, the government that creates an enemy only justifies further expansion. A corporation doesn't want enemies. It wants to reduce competition because it doesn't have the tools necessary to benefit from increased competition. But with governments, the only way a government can grow is if it has an enemy. At least that would seem to be my understanding of, you know, the political science.
Yeah, and I think it's again back to liminality, if we can ever really nail that one down. I don't suppose we will, but in terms of the very anthropological origins of communal life, let's say, even maybe the beginnings of culture, but how that is inseparable from taboo, right? The creation of taboos. Because taboo, the idea of taboo and the definition of what is taboo is what provides structure to community.
Right, and clearly in a liminal society, I'm sure you know, that taboos are basically they're torn down in hopes of creating something new. And I think clearly we're living in a society now where we have very few taboos, but I don't see us moving towards the creation of any kind of new structure. I think we're just in a state where nothing has any meaning, and that sort of creates a very unsettling effect where people are sort of clawing at each other looking for meaning. But
Go ahead. Yeah, I was going to say there's something like a rarefication, or maybe it's a complexification again, because you say that we don't have many taboos, and that's true at one level in terms of actually stuff you can just physically do. It's practically unlimited now, one way or another. But in terms of stuff you can say or even think, it's like there's this proliferation of taboos. So it's almost as though we've broken down the big taboos, and then we've got this radioactive dust or something where every little thing is potentially a taboo. So we're living in
I guess that's as far as I could go with that, but you know what I mean.
This, because there really is, there's an enormous sense of taboo, I find, just in terms of trying to have a conversation with people about what's going on in the world. There's so much that one can't say without being vilified or branded as a a taboo breaker, basically. You get ostracized. Not that I experienced ostracization, but the potential for it is there. If you say the wrong thing to the wrong person, then it's that Confederate flag again. Suddenly a symbol or an opinion or an interpretation, and you're branded as if you had, well, it's hate crime, isn't it? I mean, that's the simplest example of that.
Well, there is a potential for that, but one of the things I think of is how when I used to work in retail, things would break. It happens. But when the register breaks, there's about a 50-50 chance that when you tell the person that you're not going to be able to ring them up and they're going to have to wait for a while, there's like a 50-50 chance that they're just going to blow their stack and completely lose it. And I think that that's a good example of how people are really on edge and how it doesn't matter what the content of the message is. They're just ready to pounce on whatever. So, and I wouldn't call it a taboo to say that people are upset about registers failing, but their unwillingness to sort of like sit back and take it easy because they can't really makes it much more likely that they'll react violently or aggressively towards really innocuous things.
Yeah, but it's so, I mean, I don't know if it exactly addresses what you just said, but it does seem that there's a clear correlation there between, and this is liminality for sure, like less and less structure, as in clearly defined what is permissible and what is not, the less there are those clear definitions, the more unsafe people feel, and the more threatened they are by any expressions of identity or any ideas even that could mean that you're an enemy, let's say. Because it's not, you can't clearly point and say, well, that man is my enemy. You can't even say that man is a racist, because, you know, like the idea of a racist, that's very loaded in our society. If you can effectively call someone a racist, or better yet, an anti-Semite, you can more or less destroy their career if they have one that is as a public figure. And that, you know, that, so that's, I mean, that's a very powerful weapon in itself. But how do you identify these threats, these imagined threats? Because somebody who's a racist isn't a threat anyway. As you say, it's symbolic. It's like that flag. They're not necessarily, you know, lynching black men, right? They're not necessarily acting on it. They just have opinions that we don't like.
Right. There's definitely because of the unfixed nature of all of this language that's being thrown around, really anything can be made to stick. If it's said with enough vitriol, at least that's what they believe. And I'm not sure that that's entirely true, but that seems to be their modus operandi, just to sort of silence critics of whatever their particular ideology happens to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be a sort of motivating factor to give them meaning, is to sort of shout down other critics. And I see the sort of political correctness and what I write about in my book as being sort of connected, even though I don't write about political correctness per se in Bureaucratic Insanity. Clearly, the thesis is the same, which is that when people have lack of meaning in their lives, they act violently. And that violence can be social. It can be spiritual, and it can be sort of throwing around words that really aren't applicable. But, you know, if you can shout someone down, well, you've created meaning for yourself because you've branded them.
Yeah, well, that's the negative identity again, isn't it? If we don't have a sense of our own inner reality, we have to find it by disagreeing with things outside of us.
And to some degree, America has always sort of been that way. We've always had a sense of who we're not. Well, we're not communist, we're not fascist, we're not, you know, whatever the enemy happens to be. And that works fairly well to some degree. The problem is that when the few positive things that you do have sort of break away, meaning your relative wealth when the economy is falling apart. All you have left is the negative, and that just tends to take over everything that your life is surrounded by, is just the negative. And that can be kind of upsetting, because, I mean, if all you're doing is sort of saying what you're not, you don't have an identity of who you are, well, you're still going to try and find who you are. It's not enough to just be, well, I'm not like them. You know, I'm not a liberal, or I'm not a conservative, or whatever ideology you're trying to fight against. You ultimately do need something that you can hang your hat on, because that's stability.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was wondering that when I was reading your book, because it is specifically about America and Americans. And I think you even say at one point, I can't remember in what terms, but the suggestion is that this kind of bureaucratic insanity, and I would say it does extend well beyond, I mean, bureaucracies, and like it's in all of us to one degree or another. But anyway, that it is very not specific to Americans, but it just seems to be much more further advanced in America.
I think that the more industrialized and controlled the society, the more you're going to see it advance. So I think that it's pretty strong in, say, the UK as well,
mm-hmm.
where they definitely have comparable controls that we have here. But they also have, it's a smaller country, and so it's easier to centralize authority. So in some ways, they're quite advanced. And they definitely have all the same sort of setbacks that we have in terms of isolating technologies and sort of meaningless jobs. But the more industrialized the society generally, I think, the more we're going to see this kind of behavior.
So you don't think there's a particularly American thing? Because, I mean,
I think Americans lack positive identity, and
right.
to a profound degree compared to, say, other societies. But
it's funny, because that's the joke they make about Canadians.
Yeah, that they that they are sort of like Americans, or Americans light.
Yeah.
I definitely think that there's probably some truth to that. But Americans have always defined themselves very strongly by who they are not, whereas I don't see that so much with Canada.
No, and in American, I mean, I agree with the negative identity, but they don't, but Americans, again, it's not a conscious thing, mm-hmm. so Americans don't say, we're not fascists, they say, we're Americans. I mean, the emphasis on being American is so great that there's even something called Americanism, right? Mm-hmm. Which doesn't apply to any other nationality, so far as I know. So the American identity is a religious kind of identification, is what I've observed.
I think that is less true now, as sort of the fictions begin to boil away under the pressure of economic, sort of economic pressures we're seeing. You would think that, right. I mean, there are definitely some people who sort of double down on yeah. the Americanism, but there are others who are sort of willing to finally say the American dream is dead, hope is dead, you know, let's just burn it down and see what we can rebuild, because uh-huh. what we've got isn't what we've been promised. And there's a real hostility towards that kind of chest pounding that we used to see so common even just a few years ago.
Right.
So I do think that we're in a transitional state in that regard, where it's sort of hard to sort of just label Americans as being dogmatic, imperialist, unabashed, and shamelessly, you know, waving the flag. I mean, there is that component which still exists in this country, but over the last year or two, I would say, it's definitely been reduced considerably. And I think that the economic reality is sort of setting in, and there's a mm-hmm. sense that, you know, we could be in transitional times, possibly revolutionary times, and mm-hmm. nobody wants to be on the wrong side of history. So I think that those ideas of the sort of chest-pounding American is it's not holding up to muster like it used to.
Not even with Donald Trump, like, banging his drum?
Well, Donald Trump's message has always been that the American dream is dead. And that,
oh, so that's why he's popular. That's part of his popularity.
Right, it's the sort of willingness to admit that we are not great and that we need to make serious changes in order to get back to some kind of stability. And, you know, on one level, I sort of understand that. I don't know that it's possible, but I understand the appeal. You know, the appeal isn't entirely irrational. It's, you know, Hillary Clinton's campaign, she actually has a hat for sale which says, "America is already great," and it's a blue hat, and it's so derivative, it's insulting.
So it's her negative Trump identity.
Yeah, so, and it's, I can't, can you imagine someone actually wearing that? But, you know...
Well, it supports my wife's theory, which is that... And we don't follow politics, but anyway... that Trump was unleashed, was let out of his cage as a way to ensure that Hillary got voted president.
You know, I've heard that theory, but yeah. I'm inclined to think against it, mostly because if that was the intention, it's clearly backfiring.
Right. Brings me to a point that you make in the book, which is one of the points that I tend to disagree with, and so it can be fruitful to explore areas of disagreement, because so far we're pretty much on the same page. It's at the end of chapter 3, and you say, "In the end, the social engineers inevitably turn out to be sorcerer's apprentices, setting in motion processes that they can neither understand nor control." So I kind of agree with that. I mean, I agree with that on the largest possible sort of context, in terms of the unconscious can't be controlled, and sooner or later the unconscious is going to undo all the best laid plans of the constructed identity. But in terms of sort of a more local level, I mean, I'm somebody who has started to, another of your things that I tend to disagree with is your presenting art as a means of solution, and I certainly used to feel that way, but the more I've uncovered, I guess, in my own psyche, let's say, but also in possibly in history too, although one never knows for sure that one isn't planting the evidence, but anyway, the less inclined I am to think that any kind of social movements and any kind of individual things playing out on the world stage are separate from the social engineering plan. You know, that it all seems micromanaged to an incredible degree. So yeah, I would question that statement in your book. I mean, literally, I'm questioning it now, as in, how do you mean it, and in what ways do you think that the forces that have been conjured up by Mickey Mouse are going to, you know, get out of control?
Well, I do think that that there is a human component to, say, marketing, for example, and I don't think that the marketers who created sort of the modern, say, Republican Party, for example, and their various narratives, I don't think that they expected it to sort of blow back in their faces in the way that it has, because they created the very anger that they're seeing being directed against them now. And so that's a good example of how the establishment created a narrative that was serving their benefit for a long time and has now been directed back at them in the form of sort of a populist demagogue. And so,
what are the specifics of that?
Okay, in the United States, we sort of look at Donald Trump as being very, very much a populist, very much anti-establishment. So even though he is the Republican nominee for president, he is not widely supported among the elite, particularly in the Republican Party. But he has seized successfully on some very powerful narratives, that one of which is that the base is very angry and wants vengeance, in the kind of way that we see bureaucrats wanting to impose their will on sort of the weak and the innocent children who are sort of helpless. The Republicans want to punish the elites in a way that Donald Trump proposes to do, by sort of tearing down their system of governance, where, you know, bribery and various other forms of campaign finance. So Donald Trump is very much an upstart in sort of pushing back against this. I mean, you know, you see on television that he talks about immigration and things like that, and that's certainly a dominant theme. But his early success was really, he got a lot of success because he was so vitriolic. People wanted to support him because of how anti-establishment he was, and how he could actually be a sort of a megaphone for the negativity that the base was feeling. So The Republican establishment created sort of the vitriolic, ultra-conservative, sort of ideologically pure conservative Republican that is now sort of rejecting that and going with an extremist candidate like Donald Trump. And the establishment elites are sort of left hanging as to what to do about that. So I'm sorry if this is going a little bit into heavily into politics.
It's all right.
But there does seem to be Donald Trump is not just a typical conservative. He's very much wrecking the elite's shit, if you will. So he's causing a lot of disruptions, and clearly that was not intentional.
on the part of a particular...
In part of the media, which has enabled him and has helped to project his image and his message. The media certainly didn't want to him to be the nominee, and yet they have been his biggest supporter in reality, because even though they don't like him, they can't not pay attention to him. So that's clearly an example of where the social controls of the system have been working against their desires.
Perhaps, but wouldn't you have to posit, as I think you were suggesting at the beginning, human agency there to begin with? You said there's a human factor. So then you're really talking about individuals within the media. Like, you can't talk about the media as this monolithic entity,
right,
that has a desire, unless we're going to say, come back to the model, which I would want to come back to, really, which was that of the artificial intelligence entity that is perpetuating itself by any means necessary. So if the media, if you would say the media was a tool of a certain plutocratic elite, and then name the members of that elite and say, well, look, they're actually, you know, it's not serving their ends, etc., etc., then you could say specifically that backfired on those individuals. But if you think about the media as simply an organism that wants to generate interest and revenue and all the rest of it for itself, regardless of who's in power and regardless of whether it's getting positive or negative feedback, then you could say the media is thriving on Trump.
Well, look at it this way. Like Lewis Mumford says, we have these individual machines, but we also have the mega machine.
Yeah.
And the mega machine is all of these things working together.
Right.
So clearly the media is working as a machine, is working against the mega machine, which doesn't want to see him in a position of political power.
Wait, what doesn't want? The mega machine?
The mega machine does not want to see Donald Trump in a position of political power.
But how can we posit what the mega machine would want? I mean,
because it wants growth, it wants the centralization of power. And he would retard these things in some ways.
Well, not necessarily, because the promises Obama made had nothing to do with what he actually implemented when he was in power. So there's two different narratives right there in terms of.
Well, maybe I'm making some assumptions about what elites in general want, but my feeling is that trade is a big thing to them, and globalization, the centralization of economic power, these are things that are important to a global elite or to the traditional players in government.
But wouldn't the mega machine be entirely independent of the global elite? I mean, wouldn't the global elite just be cogs in the mega machine?
That's a good point, and that is true. To some degree, they are also subject to the whims of that global machine. But
my sense is that, and I do keep coming back to this, that the mega machine, in one way or another, I don't use that term, but the mega machine's goals would be by definition unfathomable to us mere human beings.
Well, I think that the centralization of power is something that is universal to almost all machines. And certainly it's a consistent...
Well, total control. That would relate to total control, yeah?
Yeah, to control everything that can possibly be controlled.
Right. But that's what I mean. Like, I mean, that's... We can fathom that, but... So perhaps I mean the means of such a mega machine would be unfathomable, because it would be operating on such a advanced level of sophistication in terms of crunching all the data and of human experience. And I mean, it's like a hypothetical,
right,
AI.
But once the machine becomes once the mega machine becomes an actual thing in the way that you're propositioning with your artificial intelligence theory, is once it becomes a physical thing, I mean, it will be incomprehensible to the individual. But at the same time, it does operate on a sort of logical, you know, if you had an infinite amount of time, you might be able to sort of diagnose the, you know, its justifications for various decisions.
If you had an infinite amount of time, yeah. Well, of course, that's a big if. But also, I mean, we didn't really get into AI and as a thing, and I am interested in that subject, but actually we took it in another direction, which is as or even more interesting, which was your take, which is that artificial intelligence already exists, and at least potentially, if not in reality, it would incorporate and assimilate Borg, like all of us, individual human organisms. So then we would actually be the mega machine ourselves.
Right, and there is other possibilities that, by creating an artificial intelligence, like as you noted, it could get away from us to the point where we can no longer understand its motivations. And under such a situation, it is possible that that machine could take us to a more humane future. There's no reason to think that it, with absolute certainty, that it would continue to do what we've done already with our, mega machine. So there is a small glimmer of hope that we won't continue down this path forever.
Well, I'm not sure about hope, but isn't there a basic certainty? I mean, everything is finite, and no matter how mega a machine was, it would still have finite resources to perpetuate itself. So we do have the environment itself in terms of how long it can support a particular way of life. So, I mean, that...
True, but I don't consider that much hope if it uses up, the entire planet and leaves us with nothing. It's like, oh, yes, it killed itself, but there's nothing left.
Well, there'd still be the universe.
True. In the broadest sense, I'm very hopeful that the universe will continue.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world came tumbling down. Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his world came tumbling down. Here the monkey, the monkey speaks his mind. Oh, here comes the monkey. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La fille dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Sur les arbres, prépare mon bocou. Ils sont des armes nocibles de destruction massive.
Monkey's boo.